This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a Main Street all across the state this time of day. Those real Main Streets that are the centerpieces of our communities are important places where we meet and greet each other, talk about what's on our minds, you know, share our news and opinions. And today, we're going to talk about an idea. And you don't need a big city to make an idea, a big one, work. Corey Snyder, the superintendent at Northern Cass, doesn't think so. His district was formed when several small towns consolidated their schools. Well, Snyder is trying new ideas to improve teaching and learning. In this excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast, host Tom Gerhart talks with Snyder about customized learning.
When did education become important to you, maybe even before you were out of college?
Yeah, that's a great question. I came about this a little bit different getting into education. I thought I was going to set the world on fire as a coach and the pros someday. I just had this passion for sports and coaching. And as I got into my coaching more, I was coaching football in Scranton, my old hometown. And I started realizing, like, man, it's not really about the football. It's about the kids. And geez, if I could be with kids all day, that might be a pretty good job. And I started from there to realize it was about my third year of college. Like, this is what I want to do. And this thing about education is bigger than, you know, teaching them how to run a dive or make a tackle. It's about teaching kids how to be great citizens and prepare them for life well beyond their years. And so it took a little while to get there.
When did you become aware something needed to change in the field of education? Where did you find that spark?
When I was going around and doing the training on the SLDS, I had an opportunity to be in multiple schools to talk to leaders from around the state, to talk to teachers from around the state. And it was over those 2 years that I kind of felt there was a problem with the educational paradigm we were pushing out to kids. Everybody was saying it. No one was sure how to go about changing it. And there was a lot of frustration, not with the people, but with the system.
You delivered passionate testimony about innovative education during this past legislative session. Talk about that and why it's so important to you.
Well, I'm a believer that the system is broke. Sometimes people mistake that to say we don't have great teachers or great administrators. I think in all reality, that says our teachers and administrators and students are quite remarkable because despite the system, they've still produced pretty amazing results. But the problem we have is the world we're trying to prepare kids for is changing so quick. I often tell kids, look at the phone in your hand. That's going to be the worst piece of technology they'll ever own. It seems 1 year on a phone is obsolete. Technology is going so quickly. We just need to start keeping up. And when we get to the point when we keep up, we need to start getting ahead. And the paradigm of putting a kid in a seat for 50 minutes a day, it's not working. And our students in North Dakota get into college. That's not the issue. But the problem is they're not getting out. And if they are getting out, they're getting out with a massive amount of debt and they still don't know what they want to do. And I don't blame higher ed for that. I blame the idea that we have a system, we have them for 13 years and we've done nothing to change that system.
You mentioned during your testimony that education must be transformed was a word you used. Explain and expand a little bit more upon that thought.
Yeah, I talked about tinkering and transforming. I think we're often willing to tinker. Oh, we'll adjust our schedule a little bit, or, you know, I'll change my delivery model and do a little bit more of this or something more engaging. And then we expect results to change dramatically and we're frustrated when they don't. I believe it's time to transform, which means we have to look at the system we have in place and we really have to throw it completely out. And we need to start looking at a completely different approach. We can continue to tinker. And the problem is we're going to get results, it's never going to be sustainable results. And if we can transform and we can get a whole state to transform, the results won't be just amazing for North Dakota. It will be, I really believe internationally, we'll be the very best.
Another thing that caught my attention during your testimony that is a key ingredient to all of this is your thoughts that this generation of students and learners are, you believe, the most gifted in our history. I find that to be a really bold, but also very hopeful statement.
Yeah, I say this in any speech I give to any of our patrons. And if it's the one comment that I get people to come up to me and say, how could you say something like that? How do you believe that these kids today, we blamed kids for living in a society we've created. You say, well, they shouldn't play video games, but you know, I'm the one who bought the video game console for my kids. They shouldn't have cell phones, but I'm paying their cell phone bill. We're walking around this the wrong way. And I believe that these kids today create things like we've never done. They can take and create an iMovie. They can create podcasts. They're doing things that we never dreamed of, whether we want to admit it or not. And with that comes, I think, the expectation on us to change how we deliver to these kids. Because if they're already doing more, then imagine what they could be doing if we could do more for them. It is the greatest generation. It absolutely is. And I've said one of the reasons is I don't belong in this field anymore if I ever stop believing that. It's a dangerous thing when you start blaming kids in education.
You've touched on a number of things, but let's get into the nuts and bolts. Tell us in a big picture sense first, what's happening here at Northern Cass?
We are really in year one of a transition to full mass customized learning. And you can call it personalized learning, individualized learning, competency-based. We chose mass customized. We're in a three-year transition to move away from grade levels. We will have no more pre-K, K, first, second, algebra one. Everything will be based on levels. And every kid will be placed based on where they're at according to the standards.
Governor Burgum mentioned Northern Cass in our first podcast, and he talked about you having teachers from different disciplines in the same classroom at the same time. Talk about that concept.
Yeah, so this is the first year of the Northern Cass Jaguar Academy. The academy is 8th and 9th graders, about 35 of them, who opted in and chose to be in this academy. And they basically take their course independently. It's heavier online this year than we want it to be, and we're going to reduce that down more in the future. But they kids go at their own pace. They're in there for 3 out of their 7 hours a day. We don't tell them what to do. We don't sit down and say, well, now you do English, then you do social studies. We tell them, set a goal, report that goal out. They have to email their parents, their teachers, and their academic advisor every week to say what their goal is, how they're going to get to that goal, how they're going to make progress. If they don't, they have to reflect and tell us why they didn't get to that goal. And right now, we probably have about 8 kids who have finished courses. Many of our 8th graders now are into taking high school content, high school credit courses, because they just flew through their 8th grade stuff. And what that tells me is they would have had 175 days of being bored out of their mind. But now they're in courses that are challenging. They're taking electives they want to be in. Again, it's the first step in a long-term vision of meeting kids where they are at.
My follow-up question is, I heard talk about 8th and 9th graders finishing their core courses by the end of their sophomore year and then engaging in passion areas for their final 2 years. Is that part of the academy? And can you describe a little bit more what that looks like to us?
Yeah. Initially, that was our goal, that we would take those kids and by the end of 10th grade, they basically would be done with their core courses. And when their core courses are done, it frees them up to enroll in passion areas. So if they want to take career and tech courses in Fargo, they can do that because they have nothing holding them here. If they want to take online dual credit courses, they can do that. If they want to go to the campus of NDSU or Mayville State, they could do that. It won't get there as soon as we thought. We thought that it would be a little quicker. What we're finding out is kids aren't fully on board of the idea of going completely fast. And that's been okay. We've had to kind of back off that part a little bit. But what we have started looking more at is how do we ingrain those experiences currently and not so much just at the end. So we've already had conversations about what job shadowing and apprenticeships look like for even 8th graders and 9th graders. And then we are having conversations about what does the internship look like as a senior. I would say it's a work in progress, but slowly moving forward. We hired a college and career counselor specifically for this. So we have our two counselors, elementary and secondary, but we hired an additional person. And in tough budget times, that was a bold move for us. But we knew that we had to have the right supports in place. So it will take us a little longer to get there, but we'll get there.
I wanted to ask you about supports and feedback, not only from students, but parents, school board, the community. Where does all that stand in this time of transition?
Yeah, that's a part that we're still working on. We had our first fireside chat the other day with our JAG Academy students and parents where we had them come in, we had pizza, and then we shared what's going on. To have some of the conversations that we've had with kids, one of the big conversations is we go to a pure standards-based scale. So there are no more grades for those students in their core courses. They're a 1, 2, 3, or 4. And when we said a 3, parents think that means a B. We said, no, that's not a 3, but it was a 3 when I went to school. A 3 means proficient. And so even just getting that mind shift for parents has been a big step for us. We're going to do that about three times this year. We're also in January going to have a public forum on mass customized learning to share, here's where we're going, what questions do you have, here's what it's going to look like. And we're engaging our students in focus groups to have those conversations. At our first meeting, we had a student who said something that it really made me know that this is the right work. And she had said, second hour of the day, I go sit with the band teacher because I want to compose music when I get older. And so for the second hour this whole year, I've sat down and I'm writing my own music. I would have never got to be able to do that because I would have been in eighth grade science during that time. She said it saved her. This is a place she hated to come. She says she can't wait to get up in the morning and come here because she finally has some ownership.
You're listening to an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhardt talking with Corey Steiner. He's the superintendent at Northern Cass Public Schools. We'll be back with their chat in just a moment.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Bush Foundation, investing in great ideas and the people who power them in Minnesota, North Dakota, and South Dakota. Learn more at bushfoundation.org. The Cinema 100 film series for 2018 begins on Thursday, January 11th with the American film End of the Tour. The series features 11 other films, including Loving Vincent, an animated film about Vincent Van Gogh, and Call Me By Your Name. Each film is shown on Thursdays at the Grand Theater in Bismarck at 3 and 5:30 p.m. More information is available at the Cinema 100 Facebook page.
Giving to Prairie Public is as simple as sending a text. Just text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and set up the monthly deduction of your choice. $5, $10, $15, $20 a month? It's as simple as that. Here's the deal. You give what you can, and Prairie Public delivers reliable, fact-based journalism and outstanding top-shelf programs without commercial interruption or influence. Simple. So reach for your smartphone and text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and simply support Prairie Public today. And thanks.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Today, we're sharing a conversation from the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhardt and Northern Cass Superintendent Corey Steiner.
Are you able to share ideas yet with other communities, other school districts, and unfold that for us a little bit?
Yeah, we've had multiple visits already to our school from districts around the state that have wanted to see our model. I tell them it's almost like an alternative school, except it's proactive. A lot of our alternative schools are reactive. A kid doesn't do well in the regular setting, we tried an alternative route. We're saying we're going to do that ahead of time. We're going to try something different first, and then we'll look, do we have to be more traditional? So it's just changing the paradigm. The schools that have come in have liked what they've seen. We went out and presented to some schools about the model. So we've been able to share kind of like, how do you start this? What's it look like? But also making sure people understand we don't have all the answers. This is not a perfect system. And I think we have found out it never will be, and that's okay. Messy is going to have to be okay. I think innovation and messy go hand in hand.
One thing that struck me too in hearing you speak and others is that you are able to customize learning for students. So whether you're a high achiever or someone who maybe needs a little bit more time, you're able to do that for each and every student. I think maybe some people have a perception this is for high achievers only.
That was probably the biggest misconception we had to fight when we started this. People would come and say, well, my kid, I think, would like it because school's not their favorite thing, but they won't be able to do this. And we said, well, why not? Let's try it. And it's not about your enriched kids. It's not about the kids that struggle and need extra support. Again, it's about meeting a kid where they're at. And that makes sense. If a kid is ready to take English 9 when they're an eighth grader, meet them where they're at. If a kid needs 40 weeks to do Algebra 1, let them have 40 weeks instead of cramming it into 36. This is not about where kids' abilities are, it's about where kids really are.
It seems like such a critical time in education in North Dakota. What stands in the way right now for you, for others throughout the state?
The one thing that I see that could hurt us and put some struggles or barriers in front is the funding issue. And it is not that we need to fund innovation. It's that we have to make sure that we continue to fund education, and then we find a way to recognize those ones that are being innovators. If we continue to not be able to get a per pupil increase or get some more funding, we have to look at positions like our college and career counselor, which we think is essential. For us to do customized learning the right way, it's going to be an increase in staffing. We know that, and we'll find a way to make it happen. But if funding ever gets cut, that's when we're going to have to make some really tough decisions.
On the flip side, what are we, especially as a state, doing right?
Superintendent Basler and Governor Burgum are the two perfect people to have in that position. I don't know if I've ever been in the state and I've traveled around to conferences where anybody has ever not said, oh, our Department of Public Instruction is putting this barrier in front of us. Our governor's not supportive. We have like two of the main policy setters in this state on board. We finally have people in this state, including those at our legislative branch, that are looking at this from the perspective of doing what's right for kids and not what's politically correct or right.
In many senses, and in hearing from many others, Northern Cass is really taking a lead in innovative education. What advice would you have for other educators to get them to move forward?
It's a good question. I think the first thing I would say is find what fits for your people, which means your teachers, your students, and your parents. We took a year and we really studied customized learning to figure out, was this the right fit for us? I know people would say, just jump in. I wouldn't advise that. I would say, get the toes in and figure out what works. And then find out from your staff who the runners are. We have some runners who now are implementing Mass Customized 3 years ahead of when we thought they would because they're so excited about. And then find a way to let those people go. And the other ones have clear expectations spelled out of what you expect from them down the road. And that's what we're doing. We're building a strategic plan to lay out what every teacher's expectation is. The part we probably didn't do well enough is get kids involved early. We needed to do a better job of that. Now we have to make that a priority moving forward.
I wanted to ask, what have your teachers been saying about what's happening? And can you give us their perspective on how Northern Cass has changed and adapted and looked forward?
We've had Doug Finn III, who's done this work around the country in terms of implementing a proficiency model, a customized model. Our teachers, one of them who you'll talk with later, Tom Clapp, came up to me and says, well, how do you think it went? And I go, I'm worried because I said, I thought it went great. And that scares me a little bit. And he said, people are ready to jump in the water and go 100 miles an hour right now. And I've told him, let's just take a deep breath. Let's start doing pieces. They're excited because they know it's the right thing to do for kids. This is one of the places that I will say when I came here, they told me the culture was different. And it's true. It's one of the few places that I've went where it is truly student preference. They want to do what's right for kids. And that's a really beautiful thing when that happens.
Are there some resources for other communities, school districts, superintendents, teachers, if they have questions after listening to this?
I would say the first thing you do is you do a little bit of research. The Marzano Lab has been really helpful for us. And I'm not trying to pitch them as go buy from them. But when we listened, we had a lunch with Doug Finn in Dallas. And that was the moment we're like, yep, this is it. This is the guy for us. I would tell schools, if you're thinking about doing this, start talking to other schools. I mean, that's how we save funds. 2-3 small schools together can get together and do this work together and still keep their own identity. That's always one of the fears in the small schools is you lose a little bit of who you are. But this is work that can be done together. And actually, I think there's great value in doing this work together.
Teachers always say they need time to collaborate. You mentioned schools collaborating. How do you create that time?
That was actually one of the questions and conversations we had last week. We do focus group meetings with our teachers twice a year where we bring select groups in and have conversations about what could we do. And we asked them that question. We are going to commit a significant portion of our budget to summertime. We've also said we're going to build in days where we'll get subs. We don't want to take the teachers out of the classroom, but we believe if we can schedule it for the entire year ahead of time, we can build special days around that where we have some of our speakers come in. We can do some of our STEM activities where that teacher doesn't have to be the lead instructor at that time. We know that's going to have to happen. We have sent down about half our teaching staff to Harrisburg, South Dakota, to see what their model looks like, knowing that we're not going to steal their model, but we want to take some of the things they're doing. It's been a commitment on the teacher's side. It's been a commitment on ours in terms of budget and time. The big thing I would say is ask them. I have some teachers who don't want to do it in the summer. So then I tell them, give me the idea. What do you want to do? Well, here's how I'd like to do it. All right, we'll make it happen. Just listen and find a way to do it.
When you allow yourself to dream big, thinking about all this, what do you envision for the future? What do you see?
It's still a little murky. There's no doubt about that. But I guess what I see is a fully implemented, customized model where every kid is where they're at. And people from around this country are coming here to see how we're doing this. You know, we traveled to Maine to say, wow, that was really amazing. There's a school in California that's doing things people are traveling to see. And I keep wondering, why isn't that us in North Dakota? I look at Legacy and Bismarck and think, people should be coming from around the country to see what Tom Schmidt is doing there and the teachers are doing there. That's what I want for Northern Cass. And not just us, but I want Northern Cass and I want somebody else to say, hey, we like that model. Help us. And we go help them. And pretty soon there's 10, 15, 20 models throughout the state that do this. And people come to North Dakota to visit us and Richland and New Rockford, Cheyenne, and they go around the whole state because we have this amazing, innovative approach to education.
And what does this mean 20 years down the road for learners who come back to visit you? I mean, this is quality of life. This is economy. You know, go down the road with that.
I tell our teachers, and I have to tell myself, even as a parent of two teenage daughters, I'm not preparing you for tomorrow. I'm preparing you for when you're 30 years old. If you can be self-sufficient when you're 30, you can give to the economy, you can give to your community, I will consider that very successful. If I can get that to where a kid, and I say kid because I'm getting older, is 25 and can start doing that, because when they get out of college, they know what they're going to do, they know how they want to do it, I believe that we can create a better economy, a better community, because we're going to have people that are 5-6 years ahead of the game. And that's really important for us to really consider moving forward, is this model is about kids not necessarily knowing what they want to do, but they will know what they don't want to do when they walk out of our building.
What are some steps or things we could do to promote innovative education to really get more people excited about this and maybe even just to understand it?
Yeah. Well, the Governor's Summit was a great start. Just seeing business there and the community and teachers and legislators, it was really cool to see that dynamic group of people there. I think that we need to start getting the schools that are doing some innovative things together. And what I'm going to tell you is that's not just Northern Cass. There's schools out there that are doing very innovative things. And I don't think they are thinking they're innovative, but they are. And I think we need to get those people together. I think we need to start getting cohorts of schools to start working together. We're doing a lot of this work on our own. It would have been wonderful to have some other schools to partner with us and move forward with it. We've got to build some teams because that's where our capacity is. It's kind of the wisdom of crowds philosophy.
Senate Bill 2186, how important was that to pass and be signed by Governor Burgum, at least from a big picture perspective?
I think that completely changed the game. I really believe without that, we wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. You'd have schools that were maybe skirting alongside rules and regulations, but no one that was really willing to go forward. That bill, I think, gave us the power or the confidence to move forward and move forward without any fear or worry.
I guess the final thought, and I'll give that to you, just to summarize again what's happening here at Northern Cass. It seems the palpable energy that comes with it. Just summarize what innovative education and implementing your plan has meant to this region.
Innovative education has to be about the students and not about the teachers, the administrators, the administrative assistants. Innovative education is doing what's best for kids.
You're listening to an excerpt from the Cutting Ed podcast with host Tom Gerhart talking with Corey Steiner. He's the superintendent at Northern Cass Public Schools. The Cutting Ed podcast is a collaborative effort with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Dinter-Smith. Coming up on Main Street, we'll talk with an expert about food addiction. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's acting U.S. Marshal says law enforcement will be ready in case trouble breaks out during a trial connected to the Dakota Access Pipeline protest. Redfawn Fallis goes on trial in U.S. District Court in Fargo later this month. She's accused of shooting a handgun during a confrontation with law enforcement at a protest site. The acting U.S. Marshal Dan Orr says he's been coordinating with area police departments, sheriff's offices, and federal agencies.
I can't talk about any specifics about what we are thinking about and what we've planned for, but certainly, you know, anyone can imagine the possibilities. After seeing all the events that occurred, we certainly recognize that the potential for something to happen similar. I certainly hope, and I don't believe there's a great possibility of that happening here, but we need to be prepared in case it does.
Fallis' trial is set for January 29th. Native American activists believe Fallis was illegally arrested. More than 17,000 people have signed an online petition demanding her release. The sheriff of Minnesota's Menomon County says of says investigators are trying to determine the circumstances involving a woman who was shot and is now in a Fargo hospital with serious injuries. Doug Creer says deputies were called to the Nantawash clinic shortly after 1 yesterday afternoon for a woman being treated for a gunshot wound.
She's not a local, not from the area, with a an apparent gunshot wound. She was transported to Manoman Health Center and then airlifted to Fargo. We're still trying to gather some information as to what happened. We're not even sure where it happened, where the incident took place. All we know is that she was dropped off at the clinic and the person took off and left.
The sheriff is asking that anyone with information contact his office at 218-935-2255. That's 218-935-2255. He says because the shooting was reported on the White Earth Reservation, the FBI has joined the investigation, assisting the sheriff's office, White Earth Police, and the Headwaters Drug Task Force. And the federal tax cut bill could mean lower electric and natural gas rates. That's what the North Dakota Public Service Commission believes. The PSC has opened a formal investigation on the effect of the tax cuts on those rates. Corporate tax rates went from 35% to 21% effective January 1st. Here's Commissioner Brian Crosius.
This tax reduction may provide an opportunity to reduce the rates to North Dakota public utility customers.
Commissioner Julie Fedorchuk says corporate taxes figure directly into the rates the utilities charge.
Well, it does stand to reason that when you see line items on rate cases for taxes, that when you drop that amount 14%, that there's going to be a savings because we're collecting for that and covering that in the rates.
The PSC will be asking Xcel Energy, MDU, Otter Tail Power, and Great Plains Natural Gas for information on how the tax cut will affect their finances. The commission is hoping to have the answers by mid-February. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
100 years ago, there were some tensions around here. The U.S. had just declared war on Germany, and a lot of people had relatives there. Food production needed to ramp up, just as the prime workers were going off to the Army. Native Americans wanted to volunteer, but they weren't legally U.S. citizens. Patriotism was running high. Flags, parades, and posters abounded. Hear about it on Dakota Datebook. At least once a week, we'll feature a World War I story, and you can see them on our website. Look for Prairie Public, The Great War.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by Joan Ifland. She is a PhD in food addiction, and we're going to talk about that subject today. She joins us by phone from Seattle. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's get right to the nut of this. What is addictive nutrition?
Well, what we know from the research is that some foods, when they're concentrated, they acquire addictive properties, which means that they can kind of rearrange the brain to crave intensely while the brakes in the brain are kind of disabled. And that is an addiction. It's when you're being driven to do something that you don't really want to be doing. And people are overeating and, you know, by the millions, and they don't want to be overeating, and they keep thinking it's their own fault. But one thing I hope that we can talk about today is that it's not their fault. They didn't ask for food addiction, just like we didn't ask for smoking. We didn't ask for addiction to nicotine.
Are there certain kinds of foods that, when they're concentrated, become particularly addictive?
Yes. So, of course, the one that's most obvious, that most people know about, is caffeine. And that's even in the diagnostic manual for addictions, it has its own diagnosis, caffeine addiction. And a lot of people have caffeine addiction, and they don't recognize that it really is a serious addiction. But sugar, there's a lot of evidence for sugar, and gluten has a morphine in it. Dairy has opiates in it. Processed fats has a withdrawal syndrome when we stop using them. Excessive salt. And especially when you combine them all together, then it becomes very addictive. Like in a fast food meal, you would see all of those elements.
All of the bad food groups, I guess.
Yes.
What prompted you to study this?
I got off of sugars and flours 22 years ago, the way an alcoholic gets off of alcohol. I didn't really know what sugar and flour addiction was. but I had a weight problem. I was a yo-yo dieter, and somebody said, try this. And what really got my attention was that my irritability just dropped off. I didn't want to be an irritable person, and I was doing a lot of things to try to make it stop. I had two beautiful children and a beautiful husband, and I didn't want to be irritable with them. So I got off the sugars and flours to lose weight, but I got this incredible and surprising benefit, which was I became less depressed, less anxious, less irritable, even less shamed. And now I know that the processed foods activate the stress pathway in the brain. And so my stress pathway was just working overtime, and it just faded away. It was incredible. And that's what got me hooked on being an addiction, a food addiction specialist. Right.
Well, this may not be obvious, but it sounds like an obvious question. What are the warning signs of food addiction?
Oh, that's an excellent question. So the way all addictions are diagnosed are through 11 particular behaviors that the American Psychiatric Association has published in their diagnostic manual, which we know as the DSM. So there are things like unintended use. Like you wake up and you have a plan for what you're going to eat that day and it falls apart by 10 o'clock. That's unintended use. It could be that you're spending a lot of time getting processed foods, eating it, and then recovering, like sleeping it off. Or maybe you have cravings. That's another sign. Or maybe you've tried to cut back and you have failed. And everybody has experienced that. Everybody wants to lose weight and then they regain it. So there are 11 of those criteria: withdrawal, relationship problems, inability to fulfill roles. And the more you have of those criteria, the more serious the addiction. So now there is a category of diagnosis called pre-addicted. This is coming out of Harvard, and it's a brilliant concept. What it says is, if you have one of those, let's get this stopped now, because addictions are progressive. They get worse over time. So if you're starting into addiction, if you're starting to show the symptoms, hey, stop now, you know, get the processed foods out of your house and get this thing stopped now. Get it stopped early when it's easier to stop.
We know lots of people in our country suffer from weight problems, obesity even.
Yeah.
How prevalent is food addiction?
So I did, for my doctoral research, I was able to pretty loosely but correlate food addiction with weight. So I think, in the way I think about things, I think that food addiction is driving overeating.
Are some people more prone to develop this addiction?
Yes. So there are things that do make the addiction more serious, which means that it's harder to break. And one of them is early age of onset. So if you have this as a toddler, and many toddlers do, if you have a child who's a quote-unquote picky eater, like they won't eat real food, they will only eat processed foods, you could have an addicted child. And that's something very different about food addiction. You don't have addicted children to any other substances, we know, to protect them. But processed foods are given to children, you know, willy-nilly. So they do, and they can develop processed food addiction. So I've just published a textbook in this field, the Processed Food Addiction Textbook, and I have a whole chapter in there on children food addicts. And that is, it's a little bit easier to deal with because the parent can just get the processed foods out of the house. So children who grow up in households where it's mostly processed foods are more vulnerable. Children who have been traumatized in childhood are more vulnerable, like if they've been neglected, because they will turn to processed foods for numbing. There is also a genetic component. So people who have the genetic, it's called an anomaly. It's just a little difference. Some of them are more prone to drug addiction, and it's the same genetic difference that makes people prone to processed food addiction.
Well, why are you particularly concerned about processed foods? And I guess with that question, what is it about processing that makes these foods problematic?
Okay, so plants have natural endorphins in them. It's kind of like a gift from nature. It helps us enjoy our food, and it motivates us to get food. And that's wonderful. That's not addictive. So unprocessed foods are not addictive. When you process plants and you concentrate them into a powder, or you make a syrup out of them, or you crystallize them like sugar, it concentrates the natural endorphins, and they become addictive. So with sugar and flour and gluten and excessive salt, those are all concentrated. Cheese is a concentrated product. Caffeine is, you know, it's extracting, the coffee extracts the caffeine from the ground bean, et cetera. So that's what happens.
Well, is processed food addiction more problematic than food addiction? That distinction there, I assume King Henry would eat, you know, a baron of beef or whatever he liked to eat. But is the processed food addiction more serious?
Yes. And so actually food addiction is kind of a misnomer, because what we see, this is so fascinating, and what we see in the research is that the addictive part of the brain does not light up in response to unprocessed foods. Mm. It does light up just like a drug addict's brain lights up when it, you know, like an alcoholic's brain lights up when it sees alcohol. A processed food addict's brain will light up in the same way when that brain sees processed foods. Now, what was probably happening with King Henry and eating a side of beef at one sitting, he was probably addicted to the fat in the meat. So not the meat itself, but fat does have addictive qualities, especially fat when it's combined with salt. So that could explain why he overate. I mean, and also there was general suspicion of vegetables in his era. Very interesting bit of history.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton talking with Joan Ifflin. She's the author of Processed Food Addiction, Foundations, Assessment, and Recovery, and she joins us by phone from Seattle, Washington. We do have a history, in, for example, with tobacco, of flavoring tobacco, giving it menthol and other flavors, or for that matter, alcohol, giving it various flavors to, you know, broaden the appeal, if you will. Do you believe the processed and fast food industries try to promote addiction to benefit their bottom lines?
Well, that is a very good question. So, you know, you see in my bio that I have an MBA, and I'm very interested in business practices. I did some research on this, and I found that there is a model for this, and it's called the Modern Industrial Epidemic of Addiction. And I figured out it has five A's. So there's very heavy advertising. There's heavy availability. It's very easy to get. And it's affordable, so you can buy a lot of it. It has addictive properties, often reinforced, like you're describing. And it starts at the youngest possible age. So in tobacco, for example, we saw tons of advertising, and it was available in vending machines, and initially a pack of cigarettes was a nickel in the 1930s. So before the taxation started, it was cheap.
When I was a kid going to college, they gave you a pack of three cigarettes when you went to the student union.
Yes, 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 because it takes three repetitions for the cells in the brain to start to make that addictive adaptation.
Mm, I didn't know that.
Yes, that's why you got a pack of three of them. They used to give them away on airplanes. They were on your tray in the airplane, right?
Oh, the good old days.
Okay. Yeah, that was a simple addiction compared to a processed food addiction. So, yes, you see the tobacco companies take over the processed food industry in the late 1980s. And they start to apply these principles, the same principles that they applied in tobacco. And then you see the obesity epidemic just take off.
Well, the president doesn't smoke or drink, but he's a famous fan of fast food and is reported to indulge himself often. Is he addicted?
Well, I would have to interview him, and I don't think he's become very interviewing. But I did read an episode. I read an episode in one of the tell-all books that have been published, in which his staff would coordinate the delivery of hot fast food to his plane when he was taking off from a campaign stop. Now, the amount of food in that description, to me, would qualify as a binge. So a large number of calories consumed in a very short amount of time, that is what describes a binge. And it was all fast food. And it was a lot of calories. So just, you know, I cannot diagnose from one episode, but oh my goodness, did it raise my suspicions. Yes.
Well, if he eats a Big Mac every day, is it his fault or the food's?
Okay, so I do want your people, your listeners, to get one really big thing. This is not your fault. Mm-hmm. So nobody ever, like, took the phone call and said, oh, yes, I'd like to have food addiction. And nobody ever said, oh, yeah, I'd like to become addicted to cigarettes. So it is the business practices. This is just my opinion. But it is the business practices that kind of, we catch food addiction. We don't do it to ourselves. And so that's so important to know, because once you know how you catch food addiction, then you know what to do about it. And you divide your world into non-addictive, unprocessed foods, you know, like the foods that still look like they looked at the moment of harvest. Those are non-addictive. And then you have the foods that have been processed into a powder or crystal syrup or whatever. And you just, like an alcoholic gets off of alcohol but not water. So he stops drinking alcohol, but he or she doesn't stop drinking water. You stop eating the processed foods, but you don't stop eating the unprocessed foods. That's the doorway. That's the doorway to freedom from overeating.
Well, 22 years ago, when you imposed some restrictions on your own diet, since then, do you now crave healthy foods? Can we crave what's good for us?
Not exactly. We can get hungry for what's good for us. I've started my lunch. It's over there in my kitchen, and I'm hungry for it. I feel that in my stomach. Now, a craving is quite different. So a craving is, I want something, I want something, I want something, I want something. It's in my mouth. That's different. That's very, very different. So I love my healthy foods. But what we know from the research is that healthy foods do not light up the craving part of the brain. They don't light up the dopamine pathway. They don't trigger that dopamine pathway to start releasing dopamine. Unprocessed foods don't do that. So they're not addictive, so we don't crave them.
You consult with 12-step food addiction groups, 12-step like the alcoholic kind of groups. Is that your preferred method of treatment?
Well, actually, no. There are 12-step groups for food addiction particularly. But I will tell you, this is a very complex addiction because there are so many substances involved, because they're so easily available, because we become addicted at such a young age. And because there's so much what we call cueing in the air, it's everywhere. Mm-hmm. You're face to face with processed foods all the time. So I actually have started my own online system, and people can get in touch with us at the website processedfoodaddiction.com. You can sign up to be on our email list there. And we will help you. We are dedicated. I have a whole group of people who are just dedicated to teaching people how to eliminate those processed foods from their homes, how to protect their children from developing food addiction. So, you know, we have a massive amount of help that we can give at processedfoodaddiction.com. And now the big book is out. So the definitive work, I like to think of it as the definitive work, is out at Amazon. So it's Processed Food Addiction Foundations Assessment and Recovery. And that book is out at Amazon. It's a very exciting development because that book is wholly grounded in research. There are 2,000 studies cited in that book. And so finally, people have an answer to things like, oh, there's no evidence. Nope, there's a ton of evidence. And, oh, that doesn't exist. Well, no, I mean, the very first chapter describes how processed foods are like addictive drugs. So that textbook, it's a big book, but it's written in plain language. So even a layperson could certainly read it. That, I'm hoping, will turn the tide in terms of understanding and in terms of acceptance by health professionals. So if people go to their health professional, they say, oh, you know, there's no evidence for that. Now people can say, oh, excuse me, but there's a prestigiously published textbook on this. So I'm hoping that that will give us some method for awareness, that people can become aware of the condition and what to do about it.
Do you advocate any public policy approach to this particular problem?
Not yet. Not yet. So I am a student, you know, of the tobacco industry and what happened there. So in 1964, the Surgeon General announced that it was conclusive that smoking caused cancer. It took 45 years before Congress acted. And then finally, 45 years later, Senator Kennedy got the Family Tobacco Act passed because there were four states that grew tobacco, and those eight senators kind of said, if you want us to vote on any of your legislation, you have to vote to prevent any kind of federal regulation of tobacco. And so they were able to hold that off for 45 years. So the only reason it ever became law was because there was popular acceptance that tobacco is harmful. So we have a long, long ways. There are basic public policies. You know, you prevent advertising, you make it expensive. All those five methods of spreading addiction, you counter them specifically. But we're nowhere near close to that.
Joan Ifland is the author of Processed Food Addiction, Foundations, Assessment, and Recovery. She joined us by phone from Seattle. Thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, Decoded 8 Book.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for January 10th. North Dakota remembers World War I. With the North Dakota boys now on foreign soil, news from the front was anxiously awaited, but censorship rules had tightened. Most censored items dealt with the general movement of troops and supplies. The new rules added casualty lists or letters indicating the name of the unit or the location of any soldiers. So as the heavily censored letters began arriving home, most contained the words, "Somewhere in France." The North Dakota soldiers and the 164th had moved to the eastern side of England, near Southampton, on Christmas Day. They were then transported across the English Channel during the first week of January. Meanwhile, another unit from North Dakota, the 116th Engineers, had already arrived in France. It was here that the North Dakota troops would come face to face with their first ugly signs of war, not in combat, but in the lack of accommodations and provisions. They would soon understand the tremendous toll 4 years of war had exacted on the French and English nations. 12 to 14 men were stuffed into tents made to hold 6 to 8 men. Meals were a hunk of bread, bad coffee, and a little jam. But the worst was yet to come. On this date in 1918, the North Dakota troops boarded the French 40 and 8 railroad cars designed to hold 40 men or 8 horses. They were transferred to La Courtine, located approximately 200 miles south of Paris. On their arrival, almost 4,000 privates from the 41st Division were transferred to the 1st Division as replacements. The 1st Division had arrived in France in June of 1917. Quickly organized upon America's entry into the war, it was understaffed and now, after 6 months of combat, was in dire need of replacements. The original plans had been to put each division through a 4-month training cycle, but the need for replacements countermanded this. Entire companies of the 164th and the 116th would soon find themselves in the frontline trenches. With their fighting strength greatly reduced, the 164th and the 116th engineers were assigned to the logistical and headquarters units of the American Expeditionary Force. They were located 125 miles east of Paris. Unknown to the folks back home, almost 4,000 members of the 1st and 2nd North Dakota regiments sent gloriously off to war in September of 1917 and still lacking any combat training were now scattered with frontline units somewhere in France. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Jim Davis. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Indianapolis is having trouble keeping public school teachers.
You know, with teachers not coming back at winter break, we have a new teacher and she has to start all over again.
Teachers leave because of a lack of affordable housing.
They've had to stay with parents, had to stay with roommates.
A city's effort to get teachers to stay on the next Morning Edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Thursday on Main Street, we'll talk with two famous former women's hockey players for UND, twin sisters Jocelyn and Monique Lamoureux. They're two-time Olympic silver medalists, and they'll play in the upcoming Olympics. Chef Tim Rosendahl will join us to talk about food, and Ashley Thornburg and I will share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.